Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone. This is Risky Business, and I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of the show is hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and brought to you by Tenable Network Security, makers of the Nessus Vulnerability Scanner, the stuff of legends. Before we get started, there is an absolutely fantastic job on offer for the right candidate in Melbourne. The company concerned has asked us here at Risky Biz HQ to help in the search for a talented penetration tester with consulting experience. Web application and code review skills are a must. It is a global security company that's looking, and they are a very well-respected firm. If you are based in Australia or New Zealand and you're looking for a new role and like the idea of living in Melbourne and earning fat cash working for one of the world's most awesome security firms, then please send your inquiry to Risky Business via jobs@risky.biz. Or you can call me directly on 0411 696 384. But don't go giving my number out to everyone. You know, that wouldn't be on. And just think about drinking all of that good coffee, eating in nice restaurants, heading to the night markets at Queen Vic in summer. Awesome lifestyle in Melbourne. Now, look, if you're not interested yourself, but you know someone who fits the job description, please refer them and you will get a finder's fee of $1,000 if they are successful in getting the position. So there you go. Make a grand by doing absolutely nothing. That sounds pretty good. Moving on to the show now, however, and this week we're taking a look at the full disclosure of web application security vulnerabilities. So imagine this, you're bored, you decide to start chipping away at your local bank's web application to see if they've done a good job in securing it. You find a whole host of massive holes and whammo, all of a sudden you're looking at their database. So do you A, ring the bank and tell them that you've owned them, risking prosecution for what you've done, which is almost certainly illegal? B, do you just forget about the massive holes and move your account to another bank? Or do you C, do what someone out there on the internet is doing right now and blog about it with extremely detailed screen caps so the whole world can see the web app 0 day that you've just found? Well, that's what someone is actually doing out there. I'm not kidding. On this person's blog, you'll find nothing but screen caps of owned sites and high-profile sites too, like Facebook, banks, card processors, you name it. It is there. So there is an individual or a team of people out there contributing to this thing, and they're just brazenly going out there and owning web apps and posting the results online. I think it's pretty awesome, personally, but we'll be bringing along our guest, Adam Poynton, to discuss the blog. Adam is, of course, a former pen tester turned CSO, and he works for a global publicly listed finance company that does, in fact, run a pretty complicated and busy web application for around 40,000 users. And you can bet we'll be asking him if this blog keeps him up at night. We'll also be chatting with our sponsor guest, Paul Assadorian, this week. Paul is the co-host, along with Larry Pesci, of the Paul.com Security Weekly podcast. When Paul's not in front of a microphone, he's out there being Tenable Network Security's evangelist. Praise Nessus, as he says. And this week we're chatting with him about some interesting research the SANS Institute has released, which revealed which weaknesses in corporate security are actually doing the most damage. And that is coming up later. Now, normally at this point, we would check in with our regular news guest, Mr. Adam Boileau, but he's on site this week, which means he's probably dressed in full camo gear, crawling through the scrub on the perimeter fence of some defence facility in New Zealand, owning it with a directional antenna. So, soldiers, be alert. Raise your alert status to DEFCON Unix Beard Yellow 7. That is my advice to you. So this week, instead of chatting to Adam, we're taking a trip down memory lane with the original, and I mean first episode of Risky Business original. He's the original news guest, Munir Kataria, who was the former editor at ZDNet Australia. He was last heard from on Risky Business via phone from an island in Southeast Asia between Thailand and Malaysia. He's been travelling around for a long time, but now he's back and he has a new job. He is, wait for this, the group news editor at Haymarket Media Australia and an IT security reporter for them, which is somewhat of a grammatically challenged job name if ever I've heard one. But Mun, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Cheers, mate. It's great to be back. And it, by the way, it describes me perfectly.
It describes you. Was that grammatically challenged?
Yeah, you better believe it.
So how are you finding it settling back in? Because you were gone for, what, 8 or 9 months all around Asia?
Geez, all around Asia, all around the world. It was a hell of a trip. Yeah, it's nice to be back. But I tell you what, getting back into the 9-to-5 has been a pain in the bum.
Yeah. I mean, you're in a cubicle now instead of on a beach in Koh Samui with a cocktail in your hand. But
yeah, tell me about it.
Well, look, mate, let's kick off. We've got a lot to get through. And the first news item on our agenda is Gartner, the analyst firm, has come out and issued a really bullish forecast for the security market over the next 12 months.
That's right. I mean, security software has been doing okay anyway, and they've said that basically we've had an 8% increase from 2008 for this year, and next year they reckon it's going to go up by 13%.
Now, that's better than a kick in the proverbials, isn't it?
That's right. Hopefully our industry is going to be all right. It's not going to go down like a lot of the other ones.
Well, they say the growth opportunities will come from software as a service, appliance-based offerings, and small to medium businesses, which are in security catch-up mode compared to large enterprises, which is kind of interesting, isn't it?
It is. I mean, isn't that just the way it is?
Yeah, it is. But I mean, the SMB market has been so neglected in security for such a long time, but it really does seem like they now have to play catch-up. And the other thing is, too, of course, in the enterprise, people are very reluctant to cut security budgets because they're introducing unnecessary risks.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just really, really pleased to see that they're thinking that next year it's going to be a bigger market.
That means job security for everyone.
Yay!
Yay! You can't cut our budgets. You can't cut. Anyway, look, these next two pieces, I've put them together in our news list for a reason. There's two news items here. One is about a Yahoo Mail flaw, which can basically bypass capture and allow brute forcing of users' passwords, which is similar because there was another one recently, the same sort of problem for Gmail, which stirred up some headlines a few months ago. And also there's a site somewhere overseas, probably hosted in Russia somewhere, that's offering to crack anyone's Facebook account for you for $100.
That's right. I mean, do you think your Facebook's worth $100?
Well, probably, yeah, because, I mean, then you can start writing to all of that person's friends and saying, oh, man, you know, I just got mugged. I'm in London. I need a grand. Can you send it over?
I love it.
That shit works, man. I mean, it shouldn't, but it does.
Oh, I think it's really amusing that the guys who are offering to hack the accounts, they're based in Russia somewhere, and the guys who have found it are basically saying that they're not quite sure whether it's a legitimate hacking service, if there is such a thing, or whether they're just trying to nick you $100 for trying to do it.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? Go to the police and say, I hired someone to, you know, kill someone for me or do something else illegal, and they reneged on the deal? I mean,
I think it's absolutely brilliant for these guys who have set up the site, because, you know, if they get somebody inquiring and saying, I want to hack into this Facebook account, here's $100. If it's easy and they break in, they go, there you go. If not, they steal the money and send your credit card details to the Nigerians. Either way, it's a win-win.
Win-win for them.
Yeah.
But it's interesting seeing this little capture bypass on Yahoo. I mean, they should definitely be taking care of that. But I'm starting to wonder if there's going to be mainstream consumer appeal for two-factor authentication, just something basic like a token, just to make this sort of stuff not such a big deal anymore.
Again, it's something which we've spoken about for so many years now, and it's got to happen at some point. I guess maybe it's going to be form, you know, I mean, we're looking at forms, you're talking about token. I think the mobile phone's got to be the way to go, right?
Yeah, for now, but then, you know, we're putting so much code onto mobile phones and they're all going to be vulnerable anyway, so it's sort of, I don't know. It's a tricky one, but I think for a Facebook account or an online mail account, you don't really need anything tremendously robust. I mean, a token should take care of it.
It's true. I just think we should all just get chipped and get it over with.
Get chipped? What, is it directly into the base of the brain there?
Wherever you prefer it, mate.
You go, stick it where it fits, eh? So, look, next up. Oh, now this is, I reckon, probably the most interesting story of the last week. Microsoft has been really, just in its dealings with journalists, has really been highlighting these fake antivirus packages that are advertised left, right, and center. You know, the ones that pop up and say, you're infected, give us $100 and we will give you an antivirus solution that'll take care of it. And of course, it's a scam.
Yep.
But they're even advertising on legitimate services and things like that, muddying the waters. Microsoft is actually trying to take these guys to court.
Well, it's nice that they're using their legal people for something that's actually quite useful, I reckon. I mean, I've had these things come up, and they would have fooled me, but it came up with all the Windows dialog boxes on my Mac, and so it was like, that was quite easy to spot. But if I'd had a Windows system, then I could see why that would actually get me worried though.
Yeah, no. I think these guys are getting a lot of traction, making a lot of money out of it. And it's interesting seeing Microsoft take the legal approach. And I'm really going to be curious to see if it works, because with any widespread scam that's making a lot of money, and it looks like this is making an absolute ton of money for the people behind it, hiding that sort of money is a little bit tricky, and maybe they'll have some success through the legal system.
Well, I hope so. I mean, yeah, good on them for doing that. So I do find it amusing, though, in this story, one of the paragraphs starts, it's saying Microsoft has often used lawsuits and legal actions as a way to discourage illegal activity.
That's amazing. What a revelation. That's incredible. It's like police have often been used to fight crime. Police have been known to arrest criminals.
Great story.
Yeah, yes. Fantastic. Good paragraph. Well done to the sub-editors over there, mate. That was great.
Where did that come from?
That came from you guys. Well done. Hey, look, next story, and Microsoft has actually patched what has been known as SMB V2, which is that old clanger of a vulnerability that exploits, you know, your file and print sharing services on Windows computers. But apparently, yep, they've got a fix out now for this one.
Yeah, this sounds, I mean, you know, remote code execution. I mean, I think I missed it when this one came out. I was probably still on a beach somewhere.
Well, with any luck. I mean, look, SMB was around for a long time. This SMB flaw was around for a long time, and then I think they fixed it, and now this is another one. Or, you know, I'm a little bit foggy on the details myself, to be honest, but the important thing is now it's patched, you can fix it.
Just patch them, damn it.
Just goddamn patch it. You may as well. The patch is out. Hey, this next one, again, we were actually discussing this story a couple of days ago. It's a very interesting one. This thing called the Bahama botnet, and it's a click fraud botnet, and it looks like it's actually getting some success.
Again, this is another fantastic idea by the dodgy guys there. They had 200,000 park domain sites in the Bahamas, and they're using them and basically going and clicking on adverts.
Yeah, so what it does, I mean, basically these bots park themselves on your system and then just click on, you know, fake content site these guys have turned up so they can earn ad revenue. This report comes via a company called Click Forensics, which, I mean, you know, with a name like Click Forensics, you can tell they make their money by helping publishers and advertising firms and things like that stamp out click fraud. So they do have a little bit of an incentive here to hype the threat. But we've known for a long time that click fraud is a pretty big problem. And now that we've got all these incredibly sophisticated botnets being deployed out there, infecting hundreds of thousands of systems, I mean, how would you determine a real click from a click from a botnet?
This is a real problem. I mean, how much of the traffic out there is bot traffic, and how many of these clicks are coming from there? I mean, this is like the advertiser's nightmare.
I think, look, at the moment, these guys, Click Forensics, I imagine a lot of their work is going to be in studying the behavior of these botnets and being able to work out via one means or another things that can sort a bot click out from a human click. But you just got to wonder, given a few more years and given the profitability that they're experiencing, these criminals who are doing this, I mean, they're going to be pumping a lot of money into R&D to work on countermeasures. And you've got to imagine at some point it's going to be really, really hard to determine what is a real click and what isn't.
Yeah, I mean, even right now, the story goes on to describe that, you know, that it operates intermittently, so the user doesn't know that anything's wrong. And, you know, it'll only like click when maybe they're not around or when they're... Basically, they're not going to be able to tell. It doesn't just click on all the adverts. So these guys who are writing this stuff are very, very clever, and they know how to avoid being detected.
And there's a lot of money in it too. But at least this is a crime type that doesn't actually affect individuals, which is a refreshing change. Now, in other Microsoft-related news, Microsoft has released a new tool from its Secure Development Lifecycle program internally. They've actually released a fuzzer and something else. There's another tool, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a BinScope Binary Analyzer, which allows developers to check the code at a binary level and root out areas which could be vulnerable. I like that.
And then there's the Mini Fuzz File Fuzzer.
It's a great name.
It is Mini Fuzz. Like, I would have thought Super Fuzz would be better, but... But, you know, this is interesting. Microsoft have been increasingly, of late, releasing tools to ISVs to try to help them to secure their own applications, because we've seen that attacks have moved from the operating system into applications. Mostly, you know, at first it was Internet Explorer, and then it moved into Office, and now it seems to be moving into things like Adobe products and, you know, third-party applications. So this is really good. I mean, this gives ISVs a chance to learn from Microsoft's experience and developing these tools.
And it's really great that Microsoft is sharing this experience. I mean, I guess all of these go back to the Trustworthy Computing Initiative, which they launched, about 8-9 years ago or so, and they started using these tools on their own code, and now they're sharing them. So it's a great thing.
It makes sense from a strategic point of view when you think about it, because, if someone's getting owned, even through a third-party app, do you think the average consumer, or even the average computer user, enterprise user, actually is going to blame the third-party app? No, they won't, because they'll go, it's a stinking stupid PC. Do you know what I mean?
That's totally
getting infected. So I think it is an interesting approach, and it definitely makes sense to be sharing these sorts of tools with the wider community.
Definitely. I think it's a great move. Good on you, Microsoft.
Yay, Microsoft. All right, now, ICSA Labs, which many people would know for, certifying stuff like antivirus software way back in the day, they're launching a new initiative for helping corporations protect themselves from attacks and snooping via internet-connected devices such as printers, copiers, ATMs, and security cameras, according to CNetNews.com.
That's right. It's a program called the Network Attached Peripheral Security Certification and Assessment Program. And basically all of these, they say that there's a lot of functionality on those devices being centrally managed and controlled via an internet connection, and those connections can be compromised.
There was a new standard released a while ago. Regular listeners may have heard myself and Adam Boileau discussing it, which was designed as It was called like the 2600 standard or something for network printers, which was about how to make them, more secure. And this just looks like an extension of that type of idea, which is all about, these guys are going to make money out of it by, certifying these things as being secure. But my guess is some sort of evaluation and some sort of, ranking system for these sorts of devices would probably make purchasing decisions a little bit easier for the average CSO.
Yep, I completely agree with that.
I mean, even though they're still probably going to be ownable and full of holes, at least they, at least they might mop up all the dumb shit,
Oh dear, totally. Do you know what I do find amusing though?
What's that?
It's ICSA Labs Network Attached Peripheral Security Certification Assessment Program. I couldn't help but try and run an anagram checker through that, and I came up with Pascal Panics.
Pascal, how does that work?
Pascal, the ICSA Labs NAPSC. A, P, and that's Pascal Panics.
Hang on. Napscap.
Napscap. Anal caps picks.
Nice. Nice.
Let's move along.
Let's move along, shall we, before this just descends. Okay, so here's another interesting story. I mean, it's just been such a big week for news.
It has, yeah.
But this story, which again comes from CNET, is entitled Why Virus Writers Are Turning to Open Source. Now, that's a hell of a concept to wrap your head around, but apparently malware developers are going open source in order to, share their tricks.
That's right. Apparently, 10% of the Trojan market is now open source. Now, this isn't anything new. I mean, even in the story, it says that in 1999, the Dead Crack Group launched Back Orifice, and that was open source. And I remember writing in 2004 about the Netsky author, and he launched his code open source, and that launched a whole load of viruses out there. So it's not a new thing, but 10% of the Trojan market, that's a lot of malware out there.
Open source on the desktop. We had to wait a few years, but here it is.
Finally. Not quite how we expected
how we'd planned it. But interesting anyway to see that it's picked up such a large proportion of what I guess we'd call it the market share, wouldn't we?
Yeah, an interesting thing, though, is that apparently if you're an open source Trojan, a security company can find the source code and make it easier to use their heuristics and detect against them. So they may not be the most effective way, but they definitely got some penetration there.
Well, with that happy tale, Munir, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business. Welcome back. I'm so glad you could come onto the show and reacquaint yourselves with all the listeners out there in Risky Business land.
Thanks very much, mate. It's been really good. I was actually really nervous before we started this. It's been so long.
It has been a while. Mun, thanks again, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Munir Kataria there, filling in for Adam Boileau in this week's news segment. Now, Haymarket Media, I should mention, they are the publishers of Secure Computing Magazine in Australia, and as well as itnews.com.au. And I've got to say, they have assembled just over the last year a really terrific team of journalists over there. So I can definitely recommend itnews.com.au over most of the other IT news providers out there. So you might want to go and check that out. Now, as you heard in the intro, a particularly interesting blog has popped up recently. Now, you can find it at unu, 123456.baywords.com. So UNU123456.baywords.com. And if you visit that page, what you're going to see there is basically nothing but screen caps of owned web applications. And it's not just Bob's Tire Repair Yard we're talking about here. We're think Facebook, RBS WorldPay, that sort of thing. Now, browsing through that blog is a very diverting 20 minutes, shall we say. Now, is owning sites and posting the results like this unethical? We thought we'd ask our next guest, Adam Poynton. As you heard in the intro, he is the CSO for a financial services company that operates a very complicated web application for tens of thousands of users. It's in his job description to make sure his company's application doesn't get owned. Now, because this blog is targeting companies like Adam's, we thought it would make sense to get him on the line and ask him what he thinks about all this hoo-ha.
Well, I guess it's kind of like the network worm, you know, it runs around and cleans up bad code that other people would otherwise exploit for financial gain, whereas this guy is kind of doing it for kudos and for, you know, people checking it out and having a laugh. So, you know, I guess you can look at it two ways. For like Facebook and those guys, it's kind of like free consulting. And it's also some other guys finding these bugs, publishing it, and they're going, oh, yeah, we look bad, bit of egg on the face, but we get to clean them up before somebody else mines our data, you know, uploads backdoors, et cetera, et cetera.
So let's put it this way, right? If you saw your own site on that blog, I mean, you would almost be relieved, wouldn't you, that the bug had been displayed there instead of, you know, by someone with nastier intentions.
Well, I guess, again, two ways. You know, if you saw it and the post date was like the 1st of January and you saw it in, you know, sometime in May, you'd probably be concerned. I think either way, your stomach would drop and you'd be sort of freaked out. But if you caught it early, then, yeah, you could get on it and work out what it was and fix it up. But if it was 2-3 months or even a couple of days down the track, somebody else could have got in there. I guess the other thing, from a CSO's perspective, the first thing I would do is go to the security team and say, guys, did you see this guy coming in? And if not, why not? You know, like, if there's SQL data string, like, they had, you know, Etsy password was going out on the wire and things like that through the SQL injection. So, you know, some IDS or some IPS should have seen that. The security team should have reacted. And if they didn't, why not?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because it's not just SQL injection that this guy's doing. I mean, he's going pretty hard. It's all web app stuff, but it's not just SQL injection.
No. But again, you know, there's some strings that are going out. I think most of it was HTTP from the screenshots. You know, they should be tapping SSL, et cetera, anyway. So from a detection point of view, you know, your team should be picking that up. I mean, nobody wants to see their site, you know, what they're trying to defend up on a site like that, that's for sure. But there's a lot of different ways the guys would be reacting from seeing it up there.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, like, if you're going to be vulnerable, I mean, that's the way to find out instead of having, you know, all of your customer information suddenly pop up on BitTorrent.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's better that than getting a phone call from Visa saying, hey, we think that, you know, 400,000 cards are linked to your site being cloned. So it's probably better than that, but it's egg on the face, that's for sure.
How do you think people are going to react to this? I mean, that's one thing that I wonder. I personally think that if one lone guy out there can go around owning all of these bank websites, like with his spare time for shits and giggles, then he's probably doing us a massive favour in terms of naming and shaming these people who obviously haven't put enough work into securing their sites. But, I mean, that's my reaction. But how do you think this will be received by the wider, well, I suppose the wider security community and also the wider just general IT community? Because it seems a bit controversial, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think, you know, a lot of the people in the InfoSec industry will kind of be giggling at it and giving the guy props for, like, you know, finding these bugs and publishing it. You know, everybody likes to see some SQL injection type thing like that or whatever, you know, some sort of full disk like that. I think from the site's point of view, they'll sort of be pissed that it's actually up there and that, you know, they didn't contact them directly and do the kind of right thing or whatever. But at the end of the day, they should be paying some people to get it done and shouldn't have these bugs out there. I think how it would be handled from, you know, the wider community, people will frown on it. They'll think that this guy's, you know, some sort of rogue who's running around, you know, who's obviously they, you know, have high caliber of skills and you know, have some good skills to find these issues. I'll be surprised if the blog doesn't get taken down, and, you know, so it'll probably just disappear and pop up somewhere else. But I think, you know, it's like the worm. It's like the network worm. He's going around cleaning up some issues that they really should have found themselves and should be fixed.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if this might, because, you know, for the last couple of years, I don't know if you've followed the debate, but there has been a real debate about what do you do when you find a bug in a web application, and is it even ethical to probe for bugs in web applications? Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, technically you're hacking someone else's service, right? So it's one thing to have an NT box on your network that you'd go and hard at, right? But it's another thing entirely to be going for someone's custom application on their systems. So it's there's been a bit of this to and forth about like whether or not that's an ethical thing to do in the first place, and then once you find something, what do you do with it? And I don't know. I mean, do you think that this could actually start a bit of a trend of, I mean, if there's no recourse, if there's no pushback on this guy, do you think other people could get the bright idea and start doing similar things?
I think other people will do similar things. It's been happening anyway. It has for years. It's just that, you know, these are such high profile ones all on the one blog by the same group of people or people. So, you know, again, it's kind of free consulting for the receiver, for the people who's, you know, the site who's getting affected. But yeah, it's that grey area, you know, should you allow people to do it? Someone's going to go too far. What do they do with the data? Did they walk the database out, or did they just find out how to walk the database out, then contact them to fix it? It's a very grey area.
It is. And I just sort of wonder, though, that this, you know, I mean, it would be an interesting little movement, wouldn't it? Because if you look at the hundreds of millions of card details and the thousands upon thousands of identities that get stolen from companies like this, like these companies that have been named and shamed every year, I sort of wonder that if, you know, a few hundred people out there just started going buck wild with SQL injection and other, you know, web application hacking techniques to just name and shame all high-profile institutions out there, card processors, banks, insurance companies, things like that, it would probably have a similar effect to those organizations as the early days of full disclosure did on companies like, you know, Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be drawn too far into the full discussion, but I think, you know, it's probably better than not. The fact that these people are disclosing these bugs in one way or another, whether they're sending through bug reports or, you know, posting awesome JPEGs, one way or another, they're disclosing these bugs to the company or whoever, and the security team's going around and cleaning them up. Mm. So they're getting addressed. Whereas on the other hand, they're also putting the info out there for other people to, you know, take advantage of until the company or whatever fixes the actual vulns. So yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's probably better than if they weren't to disclose them and somebody else was to find them and actually exploit them for financial or whatever gain, whereas these people appear to just be, you know, having serious lols at these organisations with foreign code.
I always love reporting, you know, friends of mine who've reported bugs to organisations, like particularly web bugs. There was one that was an airline that was reported to them, and they said, yeah, you know the one I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
They said, they basically said, well, no, at no time was, you know, the standard boilerplate response, which is at no time was customer information at risk. But then that actual box that was hosting all of that vulnerable ASP just mysteriously disappeared.
Yeah.
The same there, like, it's not a problem at all, which is why we've removed it completely from our network.
Yeah, which is an admittance of guilt, but at the same time, you know, they are doing something about it. If people hadn't have told them that those bugs were there, then it'd still be sitting out there and their customer data would be at risk.
Mm.
Whereas with people disclosing it, then it's not. But, you know, it's the fine line. If people see that, like I said, if the bug gets posted on 1st of Jan, you don't see it till May, and everybody's having lols at your site being vulnerable, and other people are actually saying, hey, I can use this and, you know, make financial gain out of it, for the win type stuff, it's an issue. But if it's picked up and addressed, you know, if maybe these people took screenshots of Facebook, posted them up, and at the same time sent a note to them saying, oh, yeah, here's where it is, you should probably fix it because, yeah, here's my blog.
Yeah, hey, check out my blog. They could write it as a Facebook note and send it to their Facebook friends.
Yeah, I'm sure it could have been slipped into all the tables in the database. I don't know.
What was the Facebook thing? I mean, how hard did they actually own it?
I think there was a whole bunch of them, but I think it was, you know, Etsy password and MySQL tables, and I think the Yahoo one, the post was talking about shell upload, so they could, you know, put code up there and, you know, but it's, again...
That's a pretty respectable score, you got to say.
Oh, yeah, hats off to them. They've done a great job. There's some really good ones up there.
I mean, totally illegal and all of that, but, you know, apart from that. Well
but at
done.
The same time, it's better than, you know, someone actually finding those bugs and saying, well, I'm going to, you know, profit from these and not tell anybody about them, whereas these people are profiting in, you know, like serious laughs and people giving these people props for finding and publishing these bugs. So
you know what's really funny, though? He's running it on WordPress.
Yeah.
That's
well,
like the
I think
irony.
They were, and then they moved away because... Yeah, but again, you know, they're putting these things up there. They're not saying, hey, this, you know, I'm hosting this on an impenetrable blog. They're just putting it up there saying that these are serious funny screenshots. These guys need to, like, check their code. And, you know, like LOL, whoever was actually being paid to pen test these companies and actually ran their eyes over the code that these people then found bugs in.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, a bit of a facepalm moment for those people, I'd imagine. But
yeah, but at the same time, it's just effort. You know, these people may have been spending months finding these issues, whereas the pen test was a couple of weeks. So.
Yeah, it depends what's in and out of scope as well.
Yeah.
The evils of scoping. Yeah, we're just going to put all of the vulnerable stuff out of scope.
Yeah.
And then you just give us a tick on the bit that we know is good.
Yeah, go look over there. That's our hardened area.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice. Any idea who this person might be or this group of people might be? Because, you know, it does have the ring of a professional pen. I mean, it's obviously not someone who's a hardcore black hat because they wouldn't be publicising this stuff. Do you know what I mean? It strikes me that it's probably someone who works in the industry.
Well, they've got some skills and, you know, they're obviously not doing it for too large of a financial gain because they'd keep these issues private and you know, sell them off or whatever they would do. You know, they're not doing that. They're having a laugh, taking some screenshots, sharing it with the wider community and people, you know, who get to laugh at in general. As to who they are, they've definitely got skills. I just wouldn't want to see any sites or anything that I'm affiliated with up there because that would be pretty shameful.
Well, mate, I hope you sleep well tonight and I hope that you do not, in fact, see your own site up there anytime soon. Adam Poynton, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
No problems, Patrick. See ya.
Adam Poynton on the line from Melbourne there. Next up, it's time for our sponsor interview. Each week, we let our sponsors come onto the show to have a bit of a chinwag, and we're lucky enough to be sponsored by very respectable companies like Tenable Network Security, so big thanks to them. And today, we're chatting with Paul Assadorian, who's Tenable Network Security's evangelist, and he also co-hosts the excellent Paul.com Security Weekly podcast with Larry Pesci. Now, I came across a report recently from the SANS Institute that claimed much of what we're doing to safeguard our networks from attackers is actually quite misdirected. In particular, the report highlighted spear phishing through client-side exploitation and web application vulnerabilities as two threats organizations should definitely be doing more to address. So I got Paul on the line and asked him what he thought about the report.
You know, when I read it, I was kind of thinking, well, yeah, that's what's hot now, but is it, you know, it's not really a representation of all of the vulnerabilities that could be present in your network. It's kind of what's happening now in the world of vulnerabilities and exploits.
Yeah, but you would agree that, you know, the bad old days of really having to struggle with securing your internet-facing systems, I mean, that's still there, but it seems to be more of an established science now. And, you know, operating system security and server security has got to a point where it can almost be relied on, right?
Well, I wouldn't, you know, it's still something that you need to perform, but attackers know that we've spent the past 10 or so years perfecting that science. So they've morphed their attacks to go around what we're starting to get good at. So, yeah, in that sense, I definitely agree with your point.
One of the key risks identified in this report is spear phishing. And that's, I kind of think that's almost good news and it's almost bad news. I mean, it's bad news because those types of attacks are proving to be particularly effective at the moment. But it's almost good news because I think it's one of those things that you might be able to effectively train your staff to avoid.
Well, it not only train your staff, but remediate as well. So how much difference is there between applying operating system patches and applying patches for third-party software? I mean, so it's not all neatly packaged from Microsoft or whatever operating system vendor, but it's still a software patch. So integrating that into your patch process, you would think wouldn't be a big deal. Yet we still see so many organizations just failing in that arena, specifically with popular applications such as Flash, such as PDF, and third-party web browsers as well. But these are just software applications that you can take whatever processes you have for applying software patches to your operating system and apply these to third-party software applications that maybe you need to purchase a third-party management solution or update your current management solution. But these programs can be patched, and that really helps solve much of the problems with client-side exploitation.
Yeah, I've found one of the problems with patch management solutions is that they're often quite vulnerable themselves, you know? Like, yes, I know that many pen testers who, like, when they find some really loose patching system, they're just like, yee-haw, now I can, you know, take this ownership of one workstation that I've got and propagate it across the whole network.
Yeah, I mean, you know, working at Tenable, I get to see a lot of vulnerabilities come across, you know, our desks and into our plugin feeds, and certainly I'm looking at the plugin feed to say, well, which vulnerabilities might be interesting for me to talk about on a podcast or a blog or whatever. And the ones that hit the patch management software, specifically if it's software running on every single piece of, you know, hardware or client system in your organization, those are vulnerabilities that are interesting, because if you compromise that software, then you can gain access to all the systems in the organization.
Tivoli, OpenView.
Yeah, I wasn't naming names.
No, you didn't have to. But I suppose, look, the other thing that I wonder about this whole concept of having to be really vigilant with patching your desktop infrastructure. I mean, I agree that's a really good idea. But at the same time, we're just seeing so much OTA in applications these days that it's still not going to cover your ass 100%.
No, yeah, you're absolutely right. And you mentioned it before, user education is very key. And I always tell people never to give up on user education. When I worked for university, you know, we didn't have control over a lot of the desktops, especially the student machines. They were student-owned machines. They would bring them into our environment. They lived in their own Class B. And how do you secure that environment? And I was like, well, one of the things we can do that's not a technical thing that we can, you know, software we can patch on their systems, but we can educate these users. And I spent a lot of time developing training programs. And while you're not going to touch and speak to every user in your environment personally and make them have that aha moment of, oh my God, I shouldn't go click on stuff and install 10 million Facebook applications. But if you can educate a certain percentage of the population, then you can kind of hope that that spreads virally through your user population and have them say, well, hey, I took this class and they said not to do that, and here's why. And it spreads amongst the users themselves. So I truly believe that a user education program can be valuable and successful.
Yeah, look, I think maybe even a bounty program for things like spear phishing. Like, if you identify a targeted spearfish against your organization, then you get a six-pack of beer or, you know, like a voucher for dinner or something like that. I mean, that's a way to get your staff motivated. And I tell you what, preventing an attack like that is worth a hell of a lot more to you than a six-pack of beer.
Well, and you know, it's funny. We sometimes talk about negative reinforcement. So the users that are bad, we're going to go beat them with sticks.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I'm a strong proponent of the positive reinforcement. So, you know, be secure and get a six-pack of beer. I think definitely works better than me than getting hit with a stick.
Yeah, yeah. Now, back in the day, you know, we used to say, okay, client-side exploitation, no problem. Just set up a really, really, really smart firewall, like a really good configuration, and you'll catch most of the shells trying to bounce out, right? Problem is now, I mean, I had this conversation with a friend of mine who works on forensics and worked on one of the breaches of the major credit card processors over in the States, you know, the Gonzalez et al. Cartel. And mm-hmm. He said that, you know, the stuff that they were talking about 5 years ago, they're now seeing it, like completely protocol compliant data exfiltration tools and things like that. I mean, that's pretty hard to defend against post-compromise, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things you can do in looking at the protocol and looking how things behave. It gets much more difficult on the client when we talk about data exfiltration, because clients are supposed to make secure HTTPS connections going outside of your network. So determining which one of those connections could be leaking your data and which one of those connections is supposed to be there as part of a secure transaction with a third-party website is very difficult. But, you know, you to speak to spear phishing specifically, and having done some incident response with respects to spear phishing, it depends on the techniques and tactics deployed by the spear phishers. Sometimes they're really easy to block, and other times they're not. And then when you start digging into the technical details, usually you can find some common denominator where you can make a change in your network, such as maybe the way that they can able to collect the email addresses within your organization. Maybe we can cut that path off so in the future those attacks are more difficult. Maybe there's things we can do on our email servers to filter in and identify some of those spam email attacks, depending on how they're structured. So there are certainly some defenses that you can put to prevent the spear phishing from happening. As far as protecting the data exfiltration, you know, there's really no good answer as far as how you determine which encrypted data streams are good and which ones aren't. I mean, yeah, there's some, you know, if the web server gets compromised and you know it's not supposed to be making a secure encrypted connection out to the internet, then that should raise a red flag. But on systems where that's allowed, that gets a lot more difficult.
Yeah, it does. I mean, even when you're proxying SSL connections, some of these protocol compliant rootkits, what would you call them? I mean protocol compliant netcat, think of it that way, that can tunnel everything through whatever, you know, make it look like legitimate HTTP traffic. That's pretty hard to pick up on, that is for sure. Another thing that I wanted to touch on briefly, you know, one of the problems identified by this report, as we said, client-side vulnerabilities. Now, a lot of these things are triggered through internet browsers that allow JavaScript, which means, say, you've got some PDF ODA, you've got some Word ODA, Excel ODA, and PowerPoint ODA. I mean, you can start background loading that stuff until you actually hit a successful exploit of a multitude of applications, just by the very nature of the way browsers work these days. How feasible do you think it is to block or at least restrict JavaScript from coming into your organization and actually being able to execute on people's desktops?
Well, I think that blocking it from the network level or in the browser level and preventing everyone from accessing a site that runs JavaScript is not feasible. I mean, anyone that's run NoScript knows the perils of trying to prevent and whitelist or blacklist sites with JavaScript. So that can be really problematic. I think a lot of the onus falls on the code that's inside the browser and maybe being able to detect what behaviors could be malicious and which ones couldn't. You know, having a JavaScript payload deployed to a client is huge. I mean, access to the browser elements, you know, stuff that the browser has access to, your browser history, your password store, your currently connected sites, it gives a lot of power to attackers. So maybe some of our saving grace falls upon protections that we can build into the browser. And I'm not talking about NoScript that prevents JavaScript from executing, but maybe there's some other protections that we can build in to build some better sandboxes around what happens within a browser context. Because so many of those attacks are just ripping apart what the browser has access to and providing the attacker with all sorts of good information.
Now, look, moving on to the other part of this report, and of course, web application vulnerabilities have been, you know, a massive issue over the last couple of years. And there's no real surprise here, is there? I mean, obviously, custom applications like web applications that we see in most enterprises now, it's only natural that the people developing them aren't necessarily security experts, and it's a relatively new field, web app security. So it's not really that much of a surprise, is it, that web application security vulnerabilities are a pretty significant issue for the enterprise?
No, I think you need to be careful as to how you look at it. You may think that, well, there are more vulnerabilities in web applications because people are out there finding them and exploiting them. And I think really the case is there's more web applications. So therefore, by nature, there's going to be more web application vulnerabilities. And I think the report definitely points that out in various different ways with pretty charts. But the fact of the matter is more people are moving their applications into the web or the cloud, if you will. And so therefore that means that that's where the vulnerabilities are going to lie. And I think that, you know, you kind of hit upon it. The people that are developing these applications don't understand security, and that is a huge problem. So now we've got these two big problems, right? More applications are moving to the web, and the people developing don't understand security. So, of course, that means that, you know, this report says that 60% of the vulnerabilities released, I've read other web application attacks, And I've read other reports that say closer to 90% of the vulnerabilities released are web application attacks. So this is you're right. It's kind of like we know this, but what do we do to fix it is the real problem.
Yeah, I mean, any suggestions there? I mean, because the solution seems to be, I mean, PCI DSS has been the biggest and greatest thing that's ever happened to web application security auditors because they're making an absolute ton of money. A metric ton, if you will, out of auditing that stuff. And I just have this sneaking suspicion that that's not sustainable. It's not sustainable for that to be part of the cost of doing business online.
Well, I think that we need to further define what auditing means. And I think PCI does kind of an okay job of it, but a lot of vulnerabilities are getting missed. And, you know, one of the things I've been doing at Tenable is working on web application vulnerabilities and how we test for them and which ones we'll test for, and gained a lot of insight into that. And it's really tricky business. I mean, you've got all kinds of dynamic things to think about with respects to cookies, with respects to authentication, with SQL injection. You have to be careful when you're testing your web application that you're not wiping out fields all over the place. So it's really an art in and of itself when it comes to web application testing and being able to define a standard that says you will go through all of these steps, and that's what a web application audit really means, is really important. I don't think PCI really addresses that. I don't think there's any other kind of standard out there that I know of that people are actively employing in their organizations that speaks to that.
Yeah, well,
because we've got the compounding problem of there's so many web applications, and to audit each one properly, you'd need a team of 20 people spending a year just auditing web applications.
Yeah, well, see, this is the thing. You know, just you mentioned standardized auditing techniques. I often wonder if there is room for more standardization in web applications themselves instead of every single company out there building one from the ground up. Do you think there's going to be room for players who come in with, you know, web applications that are designed to be secure in order to lower the sort of security testing burden that's placed on business? So you want to run an online store. You buy package that has been already PCI DSS audited, stamped compliant, all of that, been combed over by the experts, and that's sort of factored into the price, and then that cost burden is shared. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I think that's a double-edged sword. I think that would take care of a lot of the maybe common vulnerabilities that we've found out there. The problem is that if you find a vulnerability in the common framework that all these web applications are using, then you've got a vulnerability that works across multiple systems and traverses many, many different institutions' web applications, which could be kind of scary. So it's interesting how we almost gain some level of security by having all of our web applications be unique and different because the vulnerabilities present themselves differently across multiple applications.
Well, that's almost going back to Dan Gere's argument about the evils of Microsoft and monoculture, isn't it? But as we've seen, even though it's a very diverse landscape out there when it comes to web apps, the lack of monoculture hasn't actually helped, has it?
No, and that goes back to the double-edged sword analogy in that, yeah, it presents different vulnerabilities because everyone's trying to do their own thing and presents vulnerabilities differently for every application. So, you know, I think to really get to the crux of the issue is to implement a process that produces secure web applications. And I think a lot of organizations are struggling with that. And I hope that that process can be defined and refined over time to bring us to where we are with the network and level of understanding with security. So if we can bring developers up to the same knowledge and expertise of security as we are implementing with, you know, network level vulnerabilities, it's going to speak volumes in terms of adding security into our web applications.
All right. Well, Paul Assadorian, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
Thanks, Patrick.
Tenable Network Security's Paul Assadorian on the line from the USA there. And again, big thanks to Tenable for supporting this podcast. They've been helping us bring you Risky Business every week for quite a while now, and we sincerely appreciate it. And you'll probably notice that this podcast is heavily edited and usually features a minimum of 3 interviews per episode, and that actually takes a fair bit of time to pull together. So without our sponsors like Tenable, we just could not do that. So thanks again. And with that, we've actually reached the end of this week's podcast. I hope you'll tune in to next week's show and also into Risky Business 2. We've got a couple of good interviews going up there later this week, including one with Gartner analyst John Pescatore, who was in Sydney last week for the Gartner Security Summit. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.